Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today, we'll look back at a couple of moments in music history. Regina Carter, the great jazz violinist who explored West African music on her last album, has a new record full of the sounds of early 20th century Americana. Find out why when she and her band play live. And in the middle of the 20th century, actually in 1965 to be precise, a musical twist on a piece of English history became the number one song in America.
I'm Henry the Eighth, I am. Henry the Eighth, I am, I am. I got married to the widow next door. She's been married several times before. And everyone was an Henry.
Henry.
She wouldn't have a Willie or a Sam.
No, Sam.
I'm her eighth old man, I'm Henry. Henry the Eighth, I am. Second verse, same as the first.
Yes, Herman's Hermits topped the charts with Henry the Eighth, I Am, raising the question, how did this happen? Well, that's exactly the reason why we here at Soundcheck have our occasional series, That Was a Hit, all about unexpected and perhaps unexplainable chart successes. You'll hear the Herman's Hermits edition shortly. So, we'll be moving backwards through the 20th century, beginning with a fateful day in 1994.
What else should I be? All apologies. What else could I say? Everyone is gay.
20 years ago today, Kurt Cobain, the lead singer for the influential 90s rock band Nirvana, was found dead in his home from a self-inflicted gunshot with a suicide note at hand. He was 27. Cobain's influence on the so-called grunge rock scene was obvious by then, but his importance in the music world at large has been debated and analyzed for two decades since. Charles R. Cross was a part of the Seattle music culture as editor of the music magazine Rocket, and he's written a new book called Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. He's Skyping into us from Seattle. Hi, Charles.
Hi.
So, why did you feel compelled to write this book? In a strange sort of way, Larry King figures into this story, right?
Larry King figures into all my nightmares. But Kurt died in 1994, and I was editor of a magazine called The Rocket. And the moment that Kurt's body was discovered on April 8th, we were just deluded with media calls. And one of those, bizarrely, was Larry King. And I ended up on the radio with Larry King asking me the question, why did Kurt Cobain matter? And, you know, it was hard to kind of answer that, you know, to some degree on the day that he died. Two decades on, there's a larger view. I'd also, of course, written another biography of Kurt that came out in 2001, which is a straightforward telling of his life called Heavier Than Heaven.
Right.
This book is kind of the follow-up, but it's more looking at what really, this is Kurt after death, so to speak. Who did he influence? How did he change the world? And how did his life affect our culture?
So you're still answering that question 20 years later. Why did Cobain matter?
Well, I am. And I think as a society, we're still talking about him. And, you know, what's fascinating about that is we lose many entertainers, but few of them have such a long shadow on both culture, on music, and in Kurt's case, interestingly enough, even on the fashion industry.
Yeah. Musically, you can sort of take for granted how huge his shadow he casts, to the point that Rolling Stone recently revised their rating for the classic Nirvana record Nevermind. They added a star, right?
When the album first came out in 1991, when Nevermind came out, they gave it 3 stars. And then after the fact, they eventually added a 4th star in the more recent internet era. But that same album that was rated as 3 stars in 1991 was voted just a year or two ago by Rolling Stone's critics as the 17th greatest album of all time. And I kind of cite that leap to show the difference in how the album is perceived 22 years after it was first released.
Come down to my sound.
Nevermind, classic 1991 album from Nirvana. 20 years ago today, Kurt Cobain found dead in his home at the age of 27. We're speaking with Charles R. Cross, Seattle-based journalist and author of the Kurt Cobain biography, Heavier Than Heaven. His newest book is Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. All right, so musical impact. You have a page that lists literally dozens of bands who have adopted at least part of the Nirvana sound. But you mentioned a moment ago fashion. What has his impact in the fashion world been, and how surprised would he be about this?
Well, Kurt would be absolutely shocked. And, you know, some of that fashion impact already happened while he was alive in the last year or so of his life. But, you know, you began to see designers have quote-unquote grunge high fashion wear, and the same flannel shirts that Kurt had bought for $5 in an Army Navy store were redesigned by fancy designers like Marc Jacobs and were sold on Paris runways for $350 or way more. What's interesting is that grunge, that concept in music, kind of means a certain time period. But within fashion, grunge continues on today. If you went to any fashion website, let's say Nordstrom.com, and type the word grunge in, you'd find dozens and dozens of items that are described as grunge on the current fashion line for even this year.
And for Kurt Cobain, it wasn't about fashion. It was about practicality and about poverty.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I say in this book is that there has never been a fashion influencer ever who had that influence so accidentally. Kurt's ripped jeans, which now people quote-unquote call distress jeans and pay a premium for, were simply a function of the fact that he couldn't afford new jeans often.
Now, then there's the song Smells Like Teen Spirit, where, I mean, I've heard varying stories about whether he did or did not know that he was referring to a brand of deodorant with that title. What do you think?
According to what he told a few people in the band, he was not aware of that until the album was actually being mastered. In other words, until he'd already written the song, played it live, and it was done and kind of ready to go out the door. And then somebody said to Kurt, wow, I wonder what the deodorant company will think about this song. And Kurt said, deodorant company? So, you know, the irony is I kind of trace in this. This is one of the many ways that Kurt affected commercialism. You know, the sales of Teen Spirit skyrocketed when the song came out. And then the company was sold for multiple millions of dollars just a couple years later. Partly, you have to give some credit due to Kurt Cobain's influence.
Yeah.
bit of Smells Like Teen Spirit from the band Nirvana from their classic 1991 album Nevermind. We are marking the 20th anniversary of the day on which Kurt Cobain, the lead singer and rock guitarist from Nirvana, was found dead in his home at 27, marking the occasion with Charles R. Cross, whose newest book is called Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. Not a biography, that's something that Charles did back in 2001, but rather a kind of a look at why Kurt Cobain mattered. It isn't just the music. It isn't even, Charles, just the fashion. He used very quickly his platform to get across messages of anti-homophobia, women's rights, all that sort of stuff. That was a little that seems to have been kind of out of character for him, you suggest at one point in the book. He was very quiet and reticent for much of his life.
He was, but then once he kind of found himself sort of a reluctant superstar and a quote-unquote spokesperson for a generation, he kind of got lit on fire and decided to use that forum. You know, there were certainly many rock stars before Kurt and many after who have talked about political causes stretching way back, of course, to the beginnings of rock and roll with the Beatles and Concert for Bangladesh and many other causes that people have been involved in. What's unique about Kurt, though, is he is the only rock star I think there has ever been who wrote in his liner notes, "Do not buy my albums if you are a bigot." So it's one thing to come out and say, you know, I support this cause or that cause. It's another to actually try to self-modulate who is your fans are and who are buying your albums. That was a step beyond anything that any rock star did before or has done since.
And of course, as you do point out, he could not control who bought his records or who sang his songs while they were committing horrible acts. There's this terrible story of a rape. Is it in Las Vegas where the rapists are singing the lyrics from his song Polly, which was his response to a rape in Seattle?
Correct. Yeah, it was actually in Reno, and it was a response to a rape in Tacoma. But these were real life events. And Kurt was absolutely horrified that his music would end up as a soundtrack for a crime being committed. The sort of irony is that Kurt wrote three different songs about rape during the course of his career. So, you know, that's one of the ways I think he was truly different. He made what a song could even be about wider. Prior to him, people didn't write songs about these kind of topics or these themes, and Kurt kind of made that acceptable.
And on the album Nevermind, the song Polly is about this incident in Tacoma that Charles just mentioned.
Polly wants a cracker. Think I should get off her first. Think she wants some water. Put out the blowtorch. Isn't me having seed? Let me clip dirty wings. Let me take a ride. Cut yourself. Want some help? Please myself. Got some rope. Haven't told. Promise you. Haven't true. Let me take a ride. Cut yourself. Want some help? Please myself.
On Soundcheck today, we're speaking with Charles R. Cross, the Seattle-based journalist. His newest book is Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. Talking about that day 20 years ago when Kurt Cobain was found dead in his home at the age of 27, and this kind of surreal experience you had, Charles, of fielding all these calls, and suddenly one of them is Larry King saying, "You're live on my show. Why did Kurt Cobain matter?" I mean, first of all, to be cold called like that and told that you are now on, you know, broadcasting around the country and being asked a question like that, do you remember what your answer was on that day?
The day was so crazy. I mean, you know, there was one eerie element to that day that is just almost beyond belief, was that at my magazine, which was the local music magazine, we had been waiting to interview Courtney Love, and she was our cover subject. She had her album coming out that next week, and she'd blown us off four or five times. So the phone call we were waiting for all day was her. And then eventually we get a phone call that Kurt has died. And I had the grisly task of going and taking Courtney Love off the cover of the Rocket, a picture of her, and putting her now deceased husband on, Kurt. And it truly was the most surreal day of my life and one of the saddest and most horrible.
Yeah. And Courtney Love, thoroughly kind of debunks the notion of this kind of romantic suicide, you know, with the idea of the moody, brooding poet in his garret committing suicide in the 1830s or something. She just basically calls shenanigans on all of that when she does this kind of public memorial in the wake of his death, right?
Well, it wasn't just Courtney. It was also the media. Because Kurt's death was so violent and reported so widely, everybody knew that this was not like Marilyn Monroe, who took pills, and her suicide ultimately inspired many other people. The suicide rates went up dramatically after Marilyn's death. With Kurt, the violent nature of his death and the pain that everybody clearly had suffering from it in this public memorial that I write about in the book, which was truly extraordinary, I think took away some of that, if you want to call it glamour or the romanticism of what tragic suicide could be. So ironically, I found that the suicide rate in Seattle in the year after Kurt's death stayed stable or went down slightly. It did not increase or spike the way has been often been reported.
Now, you also debunk the, you know, he killed himself because of fame argument and suggest that, in fact, he had kind of a lifelong stomach ailment. He was in constant pain, and that this and the opiate addiction that he sort of got involved with in part to deal with the pain, that this was the real cause.
I think that more than anything else, some of those physical symptoms, if indeed they had been properly treated, could have shifted Kurt's life. The drug abuse was truly only the last 2.5 years of his life. And many times people look at it and think that was what it was all about. It was part of his life. It is part of his story. But in many ways, Kurt turned to drugs to kind of self-medicate and treat these physical ailments that had never properly been diagnosed.
And of course, in retrospect, you can hear lyrics like Something in the Way as a kind of a warning about, you know, a guy who feels like he's just a burden.
Underneath the bridge, top is sprung a leaf, and the animals have trapped, all become my pets, and I'm living of grass and the drippings from the ceiling. It's okay, fish, 'cause they don't have any feeding. Something in the way.
Something in the Way, the name of the song, Kurt Cobain and the band Nirvana from their Unplugged MTV session, recorded in 1993 and then issued posthumously the next year. It was 20 years ago today that he was found dead in his home at the age of 27 of a self-inflicted gunshot. And we're speaking with Charles R. Cross, whose new book is called Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. 20 years ago, Charles, you were asked, why did Cobain matter? Today, let's make it present tense. Why does Cobain matter? Why is he still influential?
I think he's still influential because the impact of those songs he wrote are still with us. Kurt had something truly unique that no one in rock has really had since. When you listened to his songs, you felt like he was singing to you, or you felt like he was singing about you. He had this way with those lyrics and those songs to truly connect with the listener. That is something you only see a few times in the history of rock and roll. And that's one reason his shadow has been so big and we're still talking about him 20 years after his death. Those songs live on long after Kurt Cobain has been gone.
Charles R. Cross, author of Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. Charles, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
The sun is gone. I think I'm done.
song Dumb from Nirvana's third and final studio album, 1993's In Utero. Coming up, the next installment in our series, That Was a Hit, looks at the British pop phenomenon known as Herman's Hermits. And later, the jazz violinist Regina Carter returns to our studio, this time with an album inspired by one of her ancestors. That's all coming up. This is Soundcheck.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
That was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Time now for another installment of That Was a Hit, our series about baffling chart success. Ah, 1965. What a great year, full of memorable number one hits.
I can't get no satisfaction.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there's no place I'm going to.
And then there were these.
Mrs. Brown, you've got a lovely daughter. Girls as sharp as her are something rare.
I'm Henry the Eighth, I am. Henry the Eighth, I am, I am. I got married to the widow next door. She's been married seven times before. And
to help us understand how a band with the improbable name Herman's Hermits scored not one but two top hits that year, we are joined once again by Chris Malanfi. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks so much, John.
So, Herman's Hermits, they are clearly part of the British invasion.
Clearly.
That Mancunian accent is almost impenetrable at times.
Seriously. Yeah, Mancunian is the word. They are a Manchester band, Herman's Hermits. The voice you're hearing, of course, is the irrepressible Peter Noon. And
was he irrepressible?
Oh, he's pretty irrepressible.
Okay.
We'll talk about where his career went after this. That guy can't be kept down. In any case, once the Beatles broke in America in 1964, it really opened the floodgates. There's a reason why we call it the British invasion. And what was fascinating was that you didn't just have, you know, other Liverpudlian acts like Jerry and the Pacemakers. You didn't just have London acts like the Rolling Stones. You had a wave of anybody with a British accent suddenly had stock in America, which is the thing I find most fascinating about Herman's Hermits in particular. It's as if the more British they were, the better they did in America. We didn't just want them to be, you know, singing catchy songs. We wanted them to be really, really British.
And did the British want bands like that?
Less so. That's the funny thing. They had a bigger career in America, at least at their peak, than they did in England. If we want to take it back to the beginning briefly, and there's not much more beginning before this because they broke in 1964, their very first hit was a number one in England, and it's a hit written by Jerry Goffin and Carole King, the famed Brill Building songwriting duo, called I'm Into Something Good, and that topped the charts in England, and that kicked off their career, and it didn't do badly here in America either. It made the top 20. But that's when it really started to snowball, and you begin to see that in America, Peter Noon becomes something of a teen idol, and the band just takes off. They have far greater success in 1965 in America on the Billboard Hot 100 than they ever did in England, including singles that were released here that weren't even released in the UK, including the two we're about to talk about right now.
All right. So the first of them is Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter. I mean, is he is he exaggerating the accent for...
I half wonder if he is.
This is a bit of improbable success from the British invasion band known as Herman's Hermits.
Mrs. Brown, you've got a lovely daughter. Girls as sharp as her are something rare. But it's sad, she doesn't love me now. she's made it clear enough, it ain't no good to pine. She wants to return those things I bought her. Tell her she can keep them just the same. Things have changed. She doesn't love me now. She's made it clear enough, it ain't no good to find.
Herman's Hermits and Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter. Number one hit for this British band here in the States. Couldn't get arrested back home in the UK, but huge here.
Yeah, and not even released as a single in the UK. They'd done okay on the UK charts, but they became a phenomenon here. What's crazy about that song in particular is that the band had no intention of releasing it as a single anywhere. They had been working several other singles, like I mentioned earlier, that kicked off with a Jerry Goffin, Carole King song. They didn't write their own stuff, so they were always looking for good material. They were working a couple of other singles in America. One was called Silhouettes. It was doing quite well and made the top 10. And then radio stations started picking up on this album cut, the Mrs. Brown song. And it kind of exploded. It kind of forced the label was MGM. It forced their hand to release it as a single.
The opening sound, that kind of skiffly, you know, muted guitar getting towards almost a ukulele kind
almost
of sound.
Almost a ukulele, yeah.
That's a really distinctive sound, kind of an old-fashioned sound.
Very much so.
And as the Beatles were doing with Sgt. Pepper around this time, there was a lot of looking back at what the Brits call music hall.
Totally. That's what was so fascinating about when the British invasion broke, there was a wave of songs where the Americans were almost being sold music hall and vaudeville sounds by the British. There was another number one hit in late 1966 called Winchester Cathedral by a band that literally called themselves the New Vaudeville Band.
Right.
And then, of course, you hit 67 and that's when the Beatles take off with Sgt. Pepper. But there's a lot of that salesman of these old-timey sounds. Now, the funny thing about Mrs. Brown is it's not actually an old song. It sounds like one. But it was written in 1963 by a guy, British gentleman named Trevor Peacock. It was originally recorded by the actor Tom Courtenay, a very well-known British actor. He was in Billy Liar, Dr. Zhivago. It was recorded for a British teleplay called The Lads. And his was the only single version that was ever released in England because, again, the Herman's Hermits version, not released in England. But when it was released in America, it exploded. It set a then record on the Billboard charts. It debuted at number 12 on the Hot 100, which was the highest debut in Hot 100 history to date.
Wow. To be surpassed only...
Only a couple years later by Hey Jude, debuted at number 10. Yeah.
All right. But we're talking about Herman's Hermits' unlikely success on the charts. Our series, That Was a Hit. Chris Malanfi's with me, pop chart analyst, contributor to NPR Music Slate, and frequent guest here on Soundcheck. Their next hit is even more unlikely because this is... something that looks back to that kind of, I mean, this is like, hey, music hall.
Right. Well, once they realized that this song that they never intended to release as a single became a number one hit, they said, okay, clearly the Americans want this music hall vibe. Let's find an actual old song. So they found a record from, no joke, 1911 that had been written by Fred Murray and R.P. Weston. And the song is called I'm Henry the Eighth I Am. Or if you're pronouncing it the way it's sung, it's I'm Henry the Eighth I Am. There's like an extra syllable in the Henry. It's not
it's
Henry.
It's like Henry.
Henry. It's like a three-syllable word.
As we would later hear with Ingerlin Swings, like
totally.
A pendulum do.
Yep.
This, an even more unlikely, number one hit for Herman's Hermits.
I'm Henry the Eighth I Am. Henry the Eighth I Am. I am. I got married to the widow next door. Married seven times before, and everyone was an Henry. She wouldn't have a Willie or a Sam.
No, sir.
I'm her eighth old man, I'm Henry. Henry the eighth I am. Second verse, same as the first. I'm Henry the eighth I am. Henry the eighth I am, I am. I got married to the widow next door. She's been married seven times before, and everyone was an Henry. She wouldn't have a Willie or a Sam. I'm her eighth old man, I'm Henry. Henry the eighth I am.
Yeah! Herman's Hermits, number one single in 1965, I'm Henry the Eighth I Am. I don't know where to begin. I tell you where I'll begin.
Sure.
Second verse,
same as the first.
I'm so glad you played that part because as best as I can tell, that is the first instance of a song of that phrase, which later became famous in punk. Joey Ramone openly extolled Herman's Hermits. He was a fan. And, you know, second verse, same as the first, which he threw into, I believe, was it Chino was a punk? He threw it into several songs.
It became like a trope.
It became a punk trope, yeah. And he totally picked it up from Herman's Hermits, from I'm Henry VIII, I Am.
So there's also, you know, for a song that is so pop and you know, has a half century of pop behind it, because as you say, a 1911 song, there's also, for British listeners, there's a little bit of a... You know, she won't have a Willie or a Sam because,
oh, yeah.
You know, there's a little,
it's a wink and a
double
nudge.
Entendre in the names, in the, one of those names.
Right. I mean, just a couple years before this song went to number one, the movie Tom Jones had won Best Picture at the Oscars. Like, it was a good time for, you know, winking, you know, nudge, yeah. Nudge, wink, yeah. Wink, British humor. And this song is fitting right in that pocket.
So Joey Ramone was a fan. Obviously, he had lots of company because both of these songs, Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, and I'm Henry VIII. Eighth I Am, are number one hits, yep. In America. What becomes of Herman's Hermits?
I mean, you know, you don't have a year like that all the time. 65 was off the charts ridiculous for them. They had seven Hot 100 hits. In 1965 alone, all of them were top tens. Also, it should be mentioned that they almost single-handedly helped to bring Mancunian, Manchester bands to the American shores. By the time Mrs. Brown went to number one, it was actually the third straight number one hit by a Manchester band. They directly followed up Freddie and the Dreamers, I'm Telling You Now, and Wayne Fontana and the Mindbenders' Game of Love. They literally went number one back to back to back. So 65 was the absolute peak. 66, they did all right. They had like three more top 10 hits. In 67, they only had one top 10 hit, but it's an extremely well-remembered one. It's a song called There's a Kind of Hush, which if you're going to hear any song by Herman's Hermits on easy listening radio to this day, it might be that one.
It's a really good song. And you mentioned the new vaudeville band before with their song Winchester Cathedral. Uh-huh. The original of this is on that record.
Is it really?
Yes,
didn't know
it
that.
Is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that song has many lives. The Carpenters covered it in the 70s. It's kind of eternal. And then finally the group outlasted the 60s and broke up in 1971.
Okay. Now, we noticed that on Amazon... there are lots of outraged Amazon customers thinking they're buying Herman's Hermits originals when, in fact, they're getting Peter Noon redos.
Uh-huh.
So there is, you know, buyer beware.
Yes.
There are lots of versions of these songs out there.
There are. And Peter Noon, as I said before, I called him irrepressible. The guy has been touring still. He was 17 when these songs broke in 1965. He's pushing 70 now. He still tours. He has a radio show on Sirius XM. He re-recorded I'm Into Something Good for the soundtrack of the movie the Naked Gun in the 80s. So, yeah, Peter has gone back to his well many, many times.
But two instances of unexpected chart success for Peter Noon and his band Herman's Hermits. And Chris Melanfi, always a pleasure. Thanks very much.
I hope you enjoyed it, John.
There's a kind of hush all over the world tonight, all over the world. You can hear the sounds of lovers in love. You know what I mean? Just the two of us and nobody else. Sight. There's nobody else, and I'm feeling good, just holding you tight. So listen.
Join us online this Wednesday and Thursday evening to watch a live video feed of Gigstock, our spring mini-festival of music and conversation inspired by our daily Gig Alert. On Wednesday at 8 p.m., it's a lineup curated by the indie concert site Oh My Rockness and features two great New York rock bands, The Pains of Being Pure at Heart. And a band that released one of my favorite New York records from last year, Parquet Courts. Parquet Courts and The Pains of Being Pure at Heart, Gigstock, Day 1, presented by Oh My Rockness, this Wednesday night at 8, on soundcheck.org. Then Gigstock Day 2 is Thursday, also 8 p.m., and our video webcast that night will feature the Irish singer-songwriter James Vincent McMorrow. And music and conversation with Connor Oberst, the singer-songwriter known for his work under the name Bright Eyes. He'll play songs from his new album, Upside Down Mountain. Connor Oberst and James Vincent McMorrow, you can watch a live video stream of that on soundcheck.org on Thursday night at 8. Coming up next, jazz violinist Regina Carter delved into family history for the songs on her latest album called Southern Comfort. We'll hear Regina Carter and her band performing some of it in our studio next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Prior to hearing Regina Carter's latest album, my immediate reaction to the words Southern Comfort would have been along the lines of, no thank you, more of a bullet bourbon man myself. But I'm happy to report that Regina Carter's new album, also named Southern Comfort, goes down pretty smoothly. And I'm looking forward to hearing some of it played live right here in the Soundcheck studio today. Now, Regina Carter and her band are going to start things off with a song called CC Rider, although it's not that CC Rider, as you will soon see. Regina Carter and her band live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
That is Regina Carter, the violinist, and her band playing live in the Soundcheck studio in a song called C.C. Rider. You'll find a version of that on Regina Carter's new album called Southern Comfort. And the members of the band include Regina on violin, Will Holzhauser on accordion, Marvin Sewell on guitar, Chris Lightcap playing the bass, and Alvester Garnett behind the drum kit. Regina, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Good to see you again.
I felt like I had to say, going into that song, that it was not the C.C. Rider that classic rock fans have heard from Mitch Rider's recording and The Animals and whatever. Where does this song come from?
This comes from an all-girls school in Alabama. It's from a field recording from the John Work III and Lomax collection. And as I was tracing my grandfather's roots on my father's side, this is one of the tunes that would have been popular during his time. My grandfather was born in 1893 in Bradford, Alabama, and he was a coal miner. So my research into my father's side of the family, doing that, I wanted to see what music would have been popular during his time.
Was this research musical in nature from the beginning, or were you just doing a little genealogy, a little family tree stuff?
Little genealogy, and it started actually with the first record of I'll Be Seeing You, tracing my mother's side. And then I joined Ancestry, did the DNA test, found out I was 73% West African, I think 13% Finnish. And
Finnish?
Yeah.
Okay. Which one? Somebody traveled pretty far.
Exactly. You know? And then with this project, when I started really delving into my father's side, I thought, man, this would be great to do a project to showcase some of the beautiful field recordings I was finding.
Did you know your paternal grandfather well?
No, he passed away before I was born, but my grandmother still had her home down in Birmingham. And she and my grandfather had 14 children, and my father was the oldest of the 14.
Wow.
He was a twin. There were two sets of twins. So all of my cousins, during the summers, we'd go down and spend time together down at my grandmother's house. Really fond memories, great food. It was still a house without a bathroom inside. You had to go to the outhouse, and hopefully you didn't have to go at night. Scary stuff.
So your research took you to the Library of Congress?
Library of Congress, and also a lot of it online, the American Folklife Association, and John Work III, who a lot of people don't know about his foundation, but he actually made it possible for Lomax to go and record and get a lot of these field recordings.
So he was like the funder. The
right.
Guy.
Well, just the person, these people trusted John Work.
I see.
You know, allow, you know, Lomax to come in and record.
Yeah. Right, because otherwise he was just this
like,
northern
this?
Guy.
Yeah,
with,
who
with,
are you?
Yeah, with, in those days,
right.
The whole back of his car full of recording gear.
Exactly.
So this is not the first time that as you mentioned just a moment ago, you know, you did that earlier record based on your mother's side of the mm-hmm. family. Last time we saw you, you had traced back to West Africa,
right.
You know, and
with
and
reverse thread.
With reverse mm-hmm. thread and woven some of those sounds in. Are you a history buff?
No. You know what? I was horrible in history in school. That's what I find funny. I can hear my mother's voice saying, is that my child? but for me, I realize that I remember information if there's music connected to it. And so when I was tracing my family and then listening to the music, it was so powerful that it really helped the information stick. And then it made me more curious. And I had, you know, people were recommending all kinds of books for me to read. I met some interesting people. William Ferris, a professor at one of the universities, helped me so much with the research and introduced me to Henry Louis Gates. Mm-hmm. So it's taken me to a lot of different places, and I've made a lot of great connections.
Wow. Regina Carter is with us on Soundcheck. The album is called Southern Comfort. Do you drink Southern Comfort?
No, I'm a Jack Daniel's girl.
All right. Okay. Yeah, it's just too sweet.
I know.
You know? but it's a great name for a record that has its roots
in the South.
The comforts of home,
yes.
And family and,
mm-hmm.
you know, down
right.
in the South, as you say. So where does I'm Going Home come from?
That's a hymn, and a very beautiful hymn, speaking of someone that has asked for forgiveness of their sins, and they're ready to make their transition. So I'm going home on the morning train. And it's something that sometimes when I go to my in-laws, I hear a tune something like that sung very in a very similar style in their church back down in Virginia. So it was just so moving when I heard the field recording that I really wanted to record it. And Adam Rogers did a beautiful job on this arrangement.
Okay. You want to play it for us?
Yes, please.
All right. Regina Carter, the violinist with her band here in the Soundcheck studio. Let's hear I'm Going Home, Regina Carter and her band live on Soundcheck. Thank you. Nice. Regina Carter and her band live on Soundcheck with the song I'm Going Home, an old hymn that appears on Regina's new album called Southern Comfort, a collection of tunes sort of built around the idea of the music that Regina's grandfather, a coal miner, would have heard. And Regina, you've been asking people to send in photos of their ancestors.
Yes.
Have you gotten, what kind of response have you gotten? Any surprises?
Well, just some really beautiful photographs that we've seen come through of people's family. One woman sent a picture of her mother, and she sent a photo of herself as well, and you see the strong resemblance. And then another sent a picture of, I believe, her grandmother, and someone else sent pictures of her three uncles, and just beautiful pictures. And you just see there's strength in all these pictures, and see the way people, you could see how people carry themselves, and there's feeling. There's some really strong feelings that come out of photographs. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, if you don't have a lot of stuff from your ancestors,
right,
the idea that you might be able to hear the same music they heard or read the same books that they read,
right,
that can be something to hold on to.
Yeah, definitely. And especially I'm finding that because, unfortunately, sometimes people just don't feel like information or photographs are important. And in my family, a lot of stuff was thrown out. So it's been difficult. But when I hear the music, I feel like, okay, it gives me a tie. I feel like I have something to hold on to.
Yeah. Regina Carter and the band performing here in the Soundcheck studio. The album is called Southern Comfort. It is out now, and it's another really intriguing blend of personal history, wider history, and music. And Regina, thanks so much for playing some of it for us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. I really appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the show, the session we just recorded with the reunited bluegrass trio Nickel Creek is proving to be very popular. If you haven't heard it yet, you can hear the podcast at soundcheck.org or on iTunes. Or just tune in tomorrow night and listen in as Nickel Creek performs songs from a new album called A Dotted Line. Plus, film and television composer Marco Beltrami talks about creating the music for Turn, the new AMC series about the American Revolution and our country's first spy ring. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team, with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, Jason Isaac, and George Wellington. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff, along with Amy Pearl. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.